This is the Waters and Harvey Show. I'm Darren Waters.
And I'm Marcus Harvey.
We're back again here with you all. Want to thank you all for joining us and continuing to tune in to the show. I'm sure that many of you had the opportunity, as we've heard from some folks, that you had an opportunity to hear the last show. Marcus and I were celebrating, I guess, what was a milestone in the show. Really, it was a milestone. And in that show, we quoted Nelson Mandela, who said, "Remember to celebrate milestones as you prepare for the road ahead." That was a really rich conversation. We had Thomas Calder as a guest. And we thought it appropriate to bring Thomas Calder on to the show because Thomas had sat down and had an interview. We did an interview with Thomas for the Mountain Express, and it was an interesting conversation. And I think, Marcus, as I think about it, I think Thomas probably got more than he bargained for in that conversation.
Right? Yeah, and you know, I think part of what was useful, or I should say, part of what was interesting to observe in the conversation that the three of us had in advance of the piece that he published recently in the Mountain Express was that, you know, Thomas really had that conversation gave Thomas the opportunity to gain insight not only into the kind of inner workings of the show, into the show's sort of origin story, but also into our friendship, right? Into the dynamics of our friendship and to really understand better the relationship between our friendship and the show. Because I think, you know, without the former, there is no latter, right? So it was interesting to share that with Thomas as someone who has been a regular listener to the show, right? I mean, I think it's one thing to talk to a journalist who's only recently discovering the show, but Thomas has been engaged with the show and with the kind of conversations that we've been having for some time now. So I think that made the conversation that the three of us had that much more robust, that right. much richer.
And, you know, Marcus, yeah. is not only a conversation with Thomas, yeah. and I want to talk a little bit more about that because it was interesting to get Thomas's perspective on the show and on certain shows that we've done. And he was able to name some of his favorite shows. I don't know that we ever got around to that question with you to talk about that. Ooh, I want to talk about that in just a few minutes. But, you know, that conversation also included you all out there in the audience, those who are regular listeners to the show. And those who are becoming new listeners to the show, because Marcus, I know the audience is growing. I watch the numbers on our Facebook page, which, you know, you and I have very busy lives. And, you know, we are, Marcus, I still put myself kind of in that old school thought. My sons, as you know, and your son, they're of different generations. My sons are of the social media age. And so they're brilliant at how they use social media. Me, not so much. And I think so much of it is because of, you know, so many things going on. You know, you as a full-time professor at the university there in Asheville, me now in this new role as Deputy Secretary for Archives and History in the state's Department of Natural and Cultural Resources, which is great. It calls for a lot. And so sometimes we're slow in maybe responding to certain messages on social media, but we do enjoy hearing from you all. We're thinking about you all. We want to, you know, kind of pick up, you know, our speed at which we respond. But we think about you all out there in the audience and what you're thinking. And it's great to hear from you. And I see the numbers, and I mentioned social media, Marcus, because I've been watching the number of people who are finding the show on Facebook and liking the Facebook page. That number is growing. And as you know, you and I've been doing a lot of work with separate entities, and they've been doing a number of stories, not only just on broader topics that you and I have been engaged in. And then when they post, you know, they link to the Waters and Harvey show. And so I'm watching the numbers of not just people here in the state of North Carolina who are finding the show and listening, but it's people outside the state, which is great. I mean, early in the show, we heard from people as far away as Ireland who had heard some of the shows that you and I had done. Then they were contacting us, asking us questions about certain things. which is just great. So it's great to continue to think about you all and know that you all are here engaged in these conversations with us. And as we prepare for that 100th show, Marcus, we, you and I put out a question, you know, for people to offer reflections about, you know, what the show had meant to them. And that show went so fast last time with Thomas on it, we didn't even get a chance to think about, okay, what is the future? So here we are at 101. I'm wondering, Marcus, as we think about that, are you up for another 100 shows?
I think so. I will say, I mean, had you asked me, what was it, in 2014 or 15, you know, if I was up for at least 100 shows, I might have balked. at that prospect. But, you know, I think given where the show is and given, you know, thinking about what you just said about the level of engagement that we're seeing on social media and elsewhere, as far as, you know, our listeners really keeping up with the show and, you know, providing feedback, raising questions, offering support. I'd have to say, yeah, at this point, I think I am up for another 100 shows. And, you know, I too have been kind of keeping track of the level of audience engagement. And also, you know, I want to just back up for a second to crack a quick joke that relates to your point
not about me, right?
No. Okay. Not this time, although I do owe you several. I owe you several. So they're coming. They're in the mail.
Okay. But, okay.
You know, my son is six. He's 6 years of age, at least mathematically speaking. He'll be starting first grade soon. And, you know, to your point about your boys who are much older and my son coming from different generations, as far as my son is concerned, I'm going to speak for you. Sometimes I don't know, because some of the stuff that he says makes me wonder if he's been here before. So I have to just put that out there.
But, I can attest to the fact that that is true, because I've often in conversation with 6-year-old Carter, who is my godson. And I think, you know, man, he sounds like an adult.
Right? Yeah, a wise adult. Sometimes, right? No, but you know, what is happening is that I'm beginning to realize how the show is helping to foment a sort of ongoing conversation that is what I would call rhizomatic, right? It's almost as if the show has sort of planted something, and then underneath it there are all of these different roots that are connected to the show and the topics that we've been discussing, and you know, but they're exploring different topics, moving in different directions, related directions, but different directions, you know, challenging us to consider topics, issues, questions that we haven't, that either we have not considered at all before, or perhaps have not considered with as much depth as we have other topics. And so there's this kind of rhizomatic process that I see unfolding, which to me is exciting. And I think the more we do the show, the greater this growth will be, I hope. But I think that's what we were after, right? Mm-hmm. In conceptualizing the show, you know, several years ago, back in 2014, 15, right? How can we take what we do as scholars? How can we take the conversations that you and I were having as professional scholars and stage translatable, accessible conversations, right, for the broader community? At that time, it was strictly just the broader Asheville community. Now, I think, mm-hmm. you know, our audience has grown far beyond the boundaries of Asheville. But how can we stage translatable, accessible conversations that grow over time, but not only grow over time, but also substantively impact people's thinking? Right, on the kinds of issues that we discuss, sharpen people's critical awareness, right, of the kinds of concerns that we explore on the show. And so for me, you know, it's exciting to see that. It gives me a level of fulfillment, right? And some assurance that, you know, the work that we were doing on the show, that the conversations that we're having are of value on some level, right?
Right.
To the broader community and to our listenership in particular.
You know, you're absolutely right. And Marcus, to think about the conversation with Thomas, I want to go back to that. And one thing we said, we wanted to illustrate what it is like to sit down and be in conversation with each other, right? Which I think is a foundational, is foundational to the building of community. We've talked a lot about community and, you know, what community means. We have asked these kind of philosophical questions, which you and I, well, I love to stay in that philosophical space. It's just a richly rewarding space to be in. And here, Marcus, I think about W.E.B. Du Bois and what he says in the introduction or in the first chapter of The Souls of Black Folks, which is one of those books that is, I think, is an important book in the American literary canon. It is one of the books that should be read by everyone. But when Du Bois talks about the segregation that existed in his time, because he's writing what in 1903 when he writes and publishes this collection of essays, and by then we know where we are as a nation. You know, strict segregation had been enacted; it was in place. But he talked about even his childhood, about, you know, when he realized that our society looked at him as being different from other people and what that meant. But he also talked about this veil. He said, so there was a veil between us and them, you know, those who were people of color, those who were not, that there was this veil that divided. But he also talked about he was able to rise above the veil and dwell with people like Shakespeare and other major writers and philosophers, because he could engage them in conversation by engaging text, right? Engaging books. And that's part of what we really wanted to get people to do, is just to be not only wanting to engage some of the books that we raise on the and topics that we engage on the show. And we get questions all the time about, can you provide us with a list of the books that you're mentioning and that you reference? But we also were hoping that what we do on the show, even when we're here alone as we are today, or if we have a guest, that people get to see us practice conversations, practice being in community with each other. And we don't always agree on everything, right, but we're able to kind of civilly go through that process. And we wanted people to be able to see that. And I think it was demonstrated in that last conversation with Thomas. And one thing I have to mention here about the conversation with Thomas that he brought up after we went off the air was the whole issue of Alexis de Tocqueville. Remember, he said that if I didn't raise Alexis de Tocqueville's name in the interview that he did with us, he was going to be disappointed. So I tried not to disappoint and raised him. I was recently did a opening talk and welcome for a group that had gathered as the Thomas Wolfe Society. And I was able to get Alexis de Tocqueville's name in there, Mark. So I found a way to get in. but nevertheless, Thomas said, if you don't bring up Alexis de Tocqueville's name, I'm going to be disappointed. But after we went off the air, Thomas told us that I think his 2-3-year-old daughter, right? And I don't have her name in front of me to remember her name, but his 3-year-old daughter, for some reason, has become fixated on a book by Alexis de Tocqueville. And while it's not Democracy in America, it is his History of the French Revolution, which was an important turning point in global history, as we know. Mm-hmm. And Thomas actually, if he were here, he could tell the story himself about how she's actually sleeping with this book. And when he tried to take the book away from her to read another story, she said, you've got to make sure that, you know, you mark my place where I am in this book. So he sent me pictures, Marcus. He actually sent me pictures of his daughter with this book, The History of the French Revolution by Alexis de Tocqueville. And I told Thomas that I was going to use those pictures to shame everybody who has not read Tocqueville.
Brilliantly put. You know, but believe it or not, I mean, you mentioned that you mentioned a moment ago that you and I don't always agree on everything. This is absolutely true. And the reality is that I don't always agree with you that the Tocqueville is as important as you suggest with respect to understanding the history of the country. I think he's important, but I think it's important to put de Tocqueville in conversation with other voices that are both contemporaneous to him, with him in the 19th century and that come after him. But I will say this, I will give you this about de Tocqueville. And, you know, just a reminder for those who don't know, we're talking about a 19th century. He was many things, right? So he was an aristocrat. He was a political sort of theorist.
I think a historian.
He was a politician. He was a historian. But believe it or not, brother, I will say this about de Tocqueville and what I take away from his huge work, Democracy in America. I think what de Tocqueville is doing there reminds me of the title of your favorite historian's autobiography, Mirror to America. I think part of what de Tocqueville was doing in the 19th century with his book, Democracy in America, was holding a kind of mirror up to America, mm-hmm. as America existed at that time.
Right.
Showing it some things that maybe the country was unable to see. Mm-hmm. Because it was too close to some of those things, right? One thing being this obsession with the future, mm-hmm. right? This disinterest in the past, right? That right. was a kind of mirror that I think the country never really looked squarely at, even after the publication of de Tocqueville's work.
Right.
Fast forward the clock to the publication of John Hope Franklin's book, Mirror to America, which has been out now for several years. I think that what's happening at this point is that the country is beginning to look in the mirror. I don't think that the country has looked squarely, but it's beginning to turn towards that mirror and see what John Hope Franklin had to say about the country as refracted through his experience. And also perhaps begin to see some of what de Tocqueville observed way back in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. Right.
I do agree. And so, Marcus, I think that's a good place to just stop for just a brief minute and take a break and remind you that you are listening to the Watterson Harvey Show on Blue Ridge Public Radio. Thank you for being here with us, and we'll be back in just a minute. Again, you're listening to the Watterson Harvey Show here on Blue Ridge Public Radio. Marcus and I, just together, we're flying solo. I guess you don't say solo, but we're flying together without a guest this time on the show. We normally have a guest, but this time it's just me and Marcus. Again, kind of talking about the issues that we raised in the last show, which was the 100th show. And again, as those of you who may be just joining us, you know, we're thinking about the quote that we used to open that last show, Marcus, from Nelson Mandela, which said, "Remember to celebrate milestones as you prepare for the road ahead." And we're thinking again about the past. We're thinking about that show that we did, and Thomas Calder was here with us, conversations that we had around the many issues, and Thomas then raising the point after the show was over about his daughter and how she's become fixated on this book by Alexis de Tocqueville. And Marcus, you have raised John Hope Franklin here, and I think, you know, which is apropos for this conversation, his book, Mirror to America. As you know, he was one of my heroes, also a mentor who helped guide a lot of my dissertation work at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm very grateful for that. And I do believe, Marcus, you're right. This idea of reflecting and looking at the reflection in the mirror. And are we there? Are we beginning to do that? I mean, you raised the point that we may be beginning to do that, but not so much in a way that is a serious reflection upon the past, upon the present, and thinking about where we want to go into the future. That last show, we talked a lot. You all were able to hear quotes from, or at least snippets from a show that we did with Mitch Landrieu. And Marcus, as you think of the former mayor of New Orleans, and Marcus, as you raised this point about reflection, And that reflection has to be based on something, right? It, we have to be reflecting upon, okay, what is it that is foundational that we're reflecting upon? And I can't help but think about Mitch raising the point in that show that we did with him, that this is a nation that is essentially a project, that we had a specific goal that we said we were kind of working towards, our the only nation, as he said, that was born out of an idea. And that idea is, we know that all men created equal, endowed by the creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And you raising that point, Marcus, and as we sit here and think about reflections, I think it's interesting that we raise this point at this particular time, because we're headed towards the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a time for us as a nation to think about it. This morning I got up, Marcus, and I was reading, you know, you and I, we read all the time, and I was reading just the preface of a book, another one of my favorite books, written by historian James McPherson. And, you know, he wrote a seminal work about the American Civil War, which was a major turning point in American history, entitled The Battle Cry of Freedom. And I highly recommend that book. It's what Marcus and I would call a tome coming out of graduate school, those tomes that we had to be familiar with. But it is a deeply engaging book. But he had another book, Marcus, which was a small book, which is a collection of essays. And the title of that book is The Second American Revolution. And he's looking at the Civil War, he's looking at it in the context of someone like Abraham Lincoln. And it's interesting that what he says about Lincoln, when Lincoln comes into the presidency, his objective in the Civil War was to save the Union, right? He all kept talking about the Union of states. We get into this major discussion among historians of who created who. Did the states create the Union? Or was it something different? You know, who are the states? Is that the people? It's kind of a chicken and egg type of discussion. But McPherson points out in the preface of this book, which is interesting, that if you follow Lincoln through his presidency, that while he goes into the presidency and he uses the word union frequently, and in his first inaugural address, he uses it, I think somewhere McPherson may say, I don't have it in front of me here, but he said maybe 20 times he uses the word union. And he only uses the word nation maybe one time. But if you fast forward to the Gettysburg Address, he doesn't say anything about the union. He talked about nation. And so McPherson is raising the point of what is the difference between union and nation? You know, the Civil War changes, you know, the way we look at America, and we become more of, McPherson argues, a nation, which is united, and less of a union of individual states. This is a question that, you know, I think is important for us to think about. And I think, you know, worthwhile you all considering here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm reminded of a point. I can't recall who made this point, but I think it was made in an op-ed, that I think was published around the time of the January 6th insurrection. But the point was made that, I want to say that David Blight's work sort of converges on this point as well. But the op-ed made the point that the country has undergone several, shall we say, foundings, right? Mm-hmm. One of which occurred essentially after the Civil War, right? So that, in other words, the Civil War Reconstruction represented a sort of a second birth, mm-hmm, of the United States, right? That prompted the country to in some ways reimagine itself. And I think that that what you're referring to in terms of Lincoln's usage of the language of union and nation, right, is reflective of that, right? I think the idea being that prior to 1865, certainly during the Civil War, there was this kind of bifurcation, right, mm-hmm, between the idea of union and obviously the Confederacy. So we had these sort of competing political bodies, these competing political entities in the country, the goal of which, at least from Lincoln's perspective, was to unify these two bodies. So Civil War ends, Confederacy loses, the Union wins, and now the idea is to forge a nation, right, mm-hmm. out of the kind of tumult that the Civil War wrought. But the question this raises for me, so if we accept that the country has undergone several rebirths, one of which occurred after the Civil War, the question that this raises for me, it connects to a point that you made about, I'm reminded of it by the title of the book that you just referenced, right? Battle Cry of Freedom. And the question for me is, well, free to do what? Right? So freedom is this sort of dominant trope in the American story, in the American experiment. An experiment, which, by the way, and this is something that has come up on the show on multiple occasions, right? But an experience that has very much that has come at the expense, right, of other people, of other traditions, of other cultures, of other communities, right? Think about America's robust Native American landscape, cultural landscape, and how that landscape was decimated by the American experiment. And so the question for me is, you know, for all of this energy within the American imagination around freedom, the question for me is, well, freedom to do, for what is freedom? Well, for one, what is freedom? Second, what are you wanting to free yourself to do exactly? And I don't know if there's ever really been much clarity about that. Right? Clarity that wasn't sort of restricted to the white American imagination in particular, right? I think from an African American perspective, there has also been talk about a struggle for like the Black freedom struggle. But even then, the question becomes, well, freedom, you know, freedom to do what? Freedom to enjoy civil rights? Is that the extent of what we mean, right, by the Black freedom struggle? And so While I think this idea of freedom, it sounds good, right? It sounds sexy and attractive and lofty and elevated. I don't know that we always know what the hell we're talking about when we use this language of freedom. We talk about, you know, freedom in an American context, and so that's what I find a little bit constructively vexing. Right. About the book that you referenced, and just about the broader sort of history of the trope of freedom in the American story.
Right. And yeah. Marcus, you raise an important and, again, I would say philosophical question. Yeah. And you're trying in this show today, I see, to keep pulling me back into back over to Alexis de Tocqueville as someone who addresses this. And I am trying, you know, because I know this has become a joke with so many. Yeah. And I'm sure with you all out there in the audience that, OK, when is and how many times will he reference Alexis de Tocqueville? But, you know, the question that you're raising here, I think, is a philosophical question. And if you read Democracy in America, you know, de Tocqueville does address the fact that Americans have a philosophy that guide them, but they don't think about it, right? Those of us in the academy do it, but American capitalism and its influence on our society is such that, okay, whatever the intellectuals are doing over there, you guys can do that so long as it doesn't impede the kind of capitalist project in that move forward. So there, most of us are happy to kind of pass off any deeply philosophical thinking about anything to those who are kind of in the ivory tower. However, I think de Tocqueville is saying that it's healthy for the broader community to think about philosophy and what are the philosophical underpinnings of our communities? I would say, what is the philosophical underpinning of our state, the state of North Carolina in this instance, or whatever state you may be listening from, or what are the philosophical underpinnings of America itself? What moves it? What guides it? But that recalls for, Marcus, you know, reflection, right? Deep reflection. And in this show, you know, I wanted to ask you, because you didn't get a chance in the last show, to really talk about what were your favorite shows. I know what your favorite shows are. They're the reflection shows, and I want to give you and I want to give you the opportunity here in a second to talk about why that the case. Sure. I remember and I recall that the first show we did as a reflection show, I can't remember the number, but the show was titled Reflections. You all can go back and find it kind of in the catalog of shows. But we began that show with a quote of saying that there are three methods by which we learn wisdom. And the first by reflection, which is the noblest. The second by imitation, which is the easiest. And the third by experience, which can be the bitterest. And we said, well, look, we don't want to deal with the easiest or the bitterest here, but we would deal with the first one, which was reflection, the noblest. And so I want to give you a chance to talk about why these reflection shows are the shows that you really, really enjoy. Not that we don't enjoy and you don't enjoy the shows that we do with guests, but you have an affinity for the reflection show. But Marcus, in response to the question that you raised, this philosophical question, here's what comes to mind. Is it the freedom, as we say, to pursue happiness? And then what does that even mean? Exactly. To me, that is a philosophical, that needs kind of philosophical, deep philosophical thought as well. What does the pursuit of happiness mean? Is that what we mean by freedom, the freedom to pursue happiness? And so what does that mean? But Marcus, you know, you can respond to that. And then in context of responding to that, I would also love to hear you talk about why the reflection shows are some of the favorite shows that we've done for you.
Yeah, well, let me say this first. I first want to go back to the point that Tocqueville made about America having a philosophy by which it proceeds, but not spending enough time reflecting, right, on that philosophy on whether or not that philosophy aligns with the nation's practice. So a question that I have is, well, first of all, I don't know that I buy, right, that there is a coherent sort of philosophical underpinning that kind of buttresses America's understanding of itself. I think that there are ideological currents that we can trace. Right. And the question then becomes, is ideology the same thing as philosophy?
I'm
not sure that it is. I mean, I think there's a very clear pattern that we can point to as American ideology. I don't see as clear a pattern that we could point to and then call it American philosophy. Mm-hmm. Maybe there is, but I don't see that clearly. So for me, one question is, are we saying that ideology and philosophy are co-equal, right? And even before that, can we even assert, is there any legitimacy to de Tocqueville's claim that there is a kind of American philosophy that is traceable across time? I would also add that even if there is such a thing as an American philosophy or American philosophies, I think it's important for us to remember that, you know, philosophies are like gardens in my mind, right? If you have a garden and you don't tend to it, then what happens? The garden dies, it withers away. I think philosophy is the same way. Philosophy is like a garden. You construct it, you nourish it, you water it so that it will grow, become stronger, and ever more productive, right? If there is such a thing as an American philosophy, I think the best that we can say at this point, given the evidence that we have seen, the social evidence, the political evidence, right, even the cultural evidence, I think the best that we can say, if there is such a thing as an American philosophy, is that garden, that philosophy has not been well tended. It has been neglected for a very, very long time, so much so that what is left is probably unrecognizable, right? So I'm not sure that I buy this whole notion that there is such a thing as an American philosophy. As I look at the sort of political history of the world, America strikes me as one of the most ideologically driven political experiments, perhaps in human history. But maybe that's overstatement. But that's a conversation for another time. But to the question,
if I can, just here and let you come back in on reflection, because you raise a really good point here, and a point that I would throw out for the audience and for you all to think about: how well are we tending the garden that is America? That's a question we can throw out. Are we tending to that garden? Or, you know, again, it would take us taking the time to be, I think, in conversation, not only amongst ourselves, but in conversation with the past, right? We would have to be willing to reflect and deal with the past, and how well are we doing that? But Marcus, as you get ready to talk about why these reflection shows are the shows that you really enjoy so much, I do want to bring up here a comment that we got from one of our listeners, because we put out that question, what has the show meant to you? And one of you, one of our listeners, Janice Mewborn, and Janice, you may be listening, we hope that you are, we deeply appreciated the comment that you sent in. And I think it, Marcus, you'll be able to kind of unpack it as you think about reflection, because here's what Janice actually said. She said that the show has, and I quote here, helped me realize how much history I don't know or have misunderstood. This has been difficult, but so important. And then she went on to say that our warmth, when she's talking about you and I, Marcus, in our relationship and how the relationship really has deepened over the time that we've been engaged, not only with the show, but in other work. But she said that our warmth and humor, especially when we talk, when the two of us talk together, along with the jazz, help soften the blow of that kind of reflection on history that she has been individually doing. And she ended up saying, I love what you are doing in raising consciousness. Mm-hmm. So I think, Marcus, you will be able to kind of unpack a little bit of what Janice, and I deeply appreciate it. That's a thought-provoking comment that mm-hmm. she sent in, and how jazz and our humor has softened the blow of that.
Let me let you respond. And I look forward to unpacking Janice's thoughts further. And Janice, if you're listening, thanks again for your email, and to all our listeners for the reflections that you shared with us regarding the value of the show from your perspective and the impact that the show has had in your lives. So before we sort of unpack Janice's comment in particular a bit more, just a few thoughts about why I appreciate the reflection shows so much. Firstly, as a professional scholar, as an educator, my natural instinct is to reflect, right? That's what I probably do most naturally at this point. At this point in my life. So reflection comes very naturally to me as an educator, as a scholar. And so any opportunity to do that, whether publicly or privately or whatever the context, is very appealing to me. And so I seize upon any opportunity to do something that to me comes instinctively at this point. So that's sort of the first thing that attracts me very strongly to the reflection shows. The second reason that the reflection shows are important to me really has to do with something that happens between the two of us. So as our listeners know, most of our shows involve a guest, right? And you and I learn a lot from these guests. I mean, these are guests that are coming from, you know, different fields, different parts of the country, you know, different professions, different perspectives, so on and so forth. And so we're constantly learning a great deal from the various guests that we have on the show. We don't always have an opportunity though, at least not on the show, to process what we've learned from these guests together. And one of the things that these reflection shows do, at least for me, is provide that opportunity for you and I to together process what we've learned from previous shows, from guests that we've had on previous shows. And that to me is just incredibly valuable, right? It's one thing for me to process in isolation, right? What we're learning from our various guests, but it's a very different thing, I think, to process those conversations with you and learn from that shared practice of processing. Mm-hmm. And so for me, you know, the reflection shows will probably always be special, right? And uniquely attractive for those reasons.
Right. Well, once again, you're listening to the Waters and Harvey Show here at Blue Ridge Public Radio. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Waters and Harvey Show here on Blue Ridge Public Radio. Marcus and I are just kind of taking the time in this show to kind of reflect upon the past 100 shows that we've done. We're talking a little bit about the previous show with Thomas Calder, and Marcus just offered some of his thoughts about what his favorite shows are. And they have been these reflection shows. And as Marcus just said, it gives us an opportunity to really process what we're learning from our engagement and conversations with other people. Marcus, I want to give you an opportunity to just go ahead and pick back up on that. And also to think about Janice. And, you know, we talked about Janice's comment, Janice Mewborn, and the email that she sent us in her thoughts and reflections about the show. And I'm just intrigued by what she said about learning, helping her learn more about history, how much she didn't know, how much has been misunderstood. Marcus, I'm engaging that also all the time. So Janice, you're not alone in that respect. And sometimes this learning some of this new history is not all rosy, right? Some of it is very hard hitting when we think about what has happened. I was just reading not too long ago a book about the massacre of African-American Civil War soldiers in a part of North Carolina at one point during the war. I can't remember off the top of my head how many of these African-American soldiers were massacred, but they were just summarily killed. And that took place here on the territory of our state. So this is ugly history, even when we think about the history of enslavement. Marcus, you've raised a point about Native American history and culture and how so much of it has been erased. I think about Latino culture in the United States, especially in the West and the Southwest of the United States, and how so much of that history has been kind of just remains invisible to us. But you're correct. And I think Janice is right, because sometimes I still am shocked, even as a historian, by some of the stories that have just kind of been passed over.
Yeah. This is a difficult one. I would say a few things. So firstly, you know, you're right. And I think Janice has observed this, history, and I'm not suggesting that history is somehow this pristine record that is not itself a kind of construction, right? A kind of authored construction. It is very much an authored construction that can be interpreted, reinterpreted, contested, so on and so forth. But the historical facts, for example, of the American experiment, as I will continue to call it, many, if not most of those facts are, I'll just say it, horrific. I mean, horrific in the scope of their violence, right? Horrific in their social impact, their cultural impact, their human impact. And though those, you know, the historical facts of the American experiment are not easy to confront. They're not easy to wrestle with. They aren't even easy to talk about, right? But we have to do it nonetheless. I think part of what makes you and I, Darren, able to talk about the historical facts of the American experiment in the way that we do, and I'll just say it forthrightly, has to do with the fact that, you know, as two African American men, you know, we have both had to struggle with the process of humanizing ourselves, right? of humanizing ourselves as Black men embedded in a society whose dominant ideology, or that has embraced a dominant ideology, perhaps since its inception, of anti-Blackness, right? So how do you find your humanity in an environment like that? Well, one of the ways that you find it is through humor, right? through creativity, through friendship, through reflection, right? Through reflection. And so I think the fact that you and I, in our individual ways, have figured out how to humanize ourselves in a in a racially hostile environment, has really helped to facilitate and strengthen our ability to talk about the brute facts of the brute historical facts of the American experiment, in a way that is accessible. Right? I don't know that we would be able to present these conversations in the way that we do were it not for, right, the fact that you and I both have had this sort of have undergone this process of having to humanize ourselves. And so I think Janice's reflections are helpful in that regard. And I also love that she referenced jazz music, right? I think jazz, stylistically speaking and structurally speaking, you know, as we've noted on the show previously, is very much reflective of our approach to staging these conversations, right? With guests, with each other. It is very much, and I'm going to just reference an idea from jazz itself, but these conversations for me are very much engaged in theme and variation, right? Variations on a theme. So we will present a theme as a sort of broad topic of conversation, and then we will sort of reflectively riff off of that theme in the same way that jazz musicians during his jazz performance will riff off of a particular melodic theme. And in so doing, sort of build a conversation across whatever instruments are involved. And so I think this metaphor of jazz music is very apropos. It's very apropos.
Right.
And it's helpful to know that approach is useful for our listeners. So thanks again, Janice, for sharing that thought.
That it offers a way. I agree, Marcus, that it offers a way to deal with some of the ugly facts and truths of the historical experience. You and I have talked in talking about jazz, and even in the last show, we referenced the work of Stanley Crouch. And here, for you all in the audience who are interested, I would recommend Crouch and his work, in one of his books in particular, which is a collection of essays called The Great American Skin Game, Art of the Decoy of Race. And it's a collection of essays. And he talks about jazz and blues. And, you know, Marcus, you and I have referenced, and I've said this before in other places, that it's interesting with the blues tradition, that we use the blues to get over the blues, right? Who goes into hearing a blues song and you don't come out of it, you know, you're kind of clapping your hands, you feel much better. So the blues are used to cure the blues. And Crouch references the founding generation of this country, America, as being somewhat blues men. They were optimists in some ways, but they were also blues men in another way, that they knew humanity was capable of doing things that we were capable of doing things that are ugly. Right. So they attempted, and he argues, to create a structure for, as we are saying now, the nation, that would allow us to use the blues. And if you look at the Constitution itself, it restricts, it tries to restrict We have gone through this process where we have amended the Constitution over time to widen what we would say the scope of freedom. We know that in the case of our the heritages and the traditions in the community that we come from, that the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendment become fundamental. I mean, Marcus, I was in a conversation with my father just recently, and I think he was very surprised to think about it in terms that he's really only one generation removed from enslavement. Mm-hmm. His grandfather, Lewis Waters, who I've talked about, and there's been work on him. Lewis Waters was born enslaved in 1860 and was freed during the general emancipation in 1865. And then that was confirmed after the adoption of the 13th Amendment. Mm-hmm. But that makes me, you know, what, really two generations removed from enslavement. I mean, it's hard to think that we've come so far, but we are so close to these periods in time. So we highly recommend the work of Stanley Crouch in thinking about jazz and blues and these traditions and what it means. Crouch also uses the term in describing America as this great American combo, gumbo, where you're putting together all of these ingredients, but you're getting something rich and that is good that mm-hmm. comes out of it. But Marcus, in order for that to be the case, you've got to be willing to admit that there's something that we get and we gain from all of these cultural traditions that make up this American experience, right? This American experiment. So let me turn it over to
you. And I would just say, along with Stanley Crouch, when I've referenced him before, one of my absolute favorite thinkers is Albert Murray.
Yes.
And there's also a jazz critic, cultural critic, social critic, but there's a book that he's written that I highly recommend our readers take a look at. It's entitled The Blue Devils of Nada. The Blue Devils of Nada, A Contemporary American Approach to Aesthetic Statement. And thinking about the blues, there's a quick quote that I want to read from that text where in his characteristic way, Murray is reflecting on the blues. So he says, but no matter how they being the blues, no matter how they come to be there again, the main thing about them is all the botheration they bring. And your most immediate concern is how to dislodge them before the botheration degenerates into utter hopelessness. So the very first problem that it all adds up to is as specific as is the ghost-like vagueness of their very existence. What it requires, he says, is the primordial and ever-persistent effort to purify the environment once more. So what's significant for me from that sort of analysis of the blues in the African-American experience is that the blues plays a role in our effort to use Murray's language, quote unquote, purify the environment so that we can find our humanity. Right. So it's through the way in which the blues idioms, the jazz idioms, help us to wrestle with the brute reality of our experience within the American experiment. It's through that wrestling that we're able to forge an environment where we can find our humanity, right? Mm-hmm. But that work of wrestling is difficult, it's painful, right. It's frightening, it haunts us. He talks about a ghost-like quality, right? When he reflects on the blues. And this is why people like Cornel West, you know, would agree that for him, African-Americans are a blues people, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I would go that far, but I see why West would say that. So yeah, I highly recommend this text. Again, The Blue Devils of Nada, A Contemporary American Approach to Aesthetic Statement, Albert Murray.
Right. And if you're like, you know, Janice, and you're finding that jazz and thinking about the blues helps to soften the blow a little bit, you know, there are other texts that you write. I'm glad, Marcus, that you raised the book by Albert Murray, and also his book Omni-Americans is a really Absolutely. Good one to engage as well. And we'd also offer up, you know, as another title, Amiri Baraka, his book The Blues People, which was a book that Cornel West did recommend Absolutely. To me. And it kind of charts American history and especially the African American experience through music. And so it's a really rich text. So we've come to the end of this show. Marcus and I, you know, we told you all last time that we have outlines in front of us when we do these shows, but those quickly go out the door. As it should be, Marcus, because conversations.
Let's just go outline less from here on out. There's no more outline.
We should, no more planning. We'll just jump in. But I, which is as it should be, because conversation should be organic. And I feel that every conversation that I'm in with you, brother, is a very organic and enriching conversation. We hope that you all find that to be the case with us too. Marcus, as we were thinking about, as we went through this conversation, I thought about the tension that exists between in America and the tension in American history between individuality and community. And it made me think of a quote or a piece from a brief piece and statement from Albert Einstein in his piece, What I Believe. And he started that piece out by saying, strange is our situation here upon earth. Each of us comes here for a short visit, not knowing why, yet sometimes seeming to divine a purpose. From the standpoint of daily life, however, there's one thing we do know, that man, and I would say that human beings are human beings, I would put that man is here for the sake of other men, above all, for those upon whose smiles and well-being our own happiness depends. And he goes on to say more there, but I think that that's a rich one to engage. So thank you all for joining us in this show. Marcus and I really, again, appreciate having you here. We want to remind you that the Waters and Harvey Show is produced at Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, North Carolina, and in partnership with the Institute for the Promotion of Human Understanding.
And you can listen to our podcast on BPR.org, the BPR and NPR One mobile apps, and on Apple Podcasts and Google Play.
And again, you can follow us and get in touch on Facebook and Twitter, or you can write us at whshow@bpr.org. And Marcus and I will look forward to engaging you in conversation next time.
Take care.